Hello and welcome to a PrivCap podcast. I'm David Snow, a partner at PrivCap Media. And today we're joined by Rippon Kadakia of ZMC, Julie Kelly, and Victor Cao, both of RSM. Julie, Victor, and Rippon, welcome to PrivCap today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, David.
We're talking all about investing in the changing media landscape. Obviously, that's a big landscape. It has been evolving quite a bit over the past 20 years. Speaking of which, why don't we start with a real quick anecdote from Victor. Victor, you recently paid a visit to a business that you will name in Bend, Oregon, that taught you something about the changing media landscape. Tell us a bit about that visit, please, Victor.
It was the last official Blockbuster in all the globe, and it just so happens to be in Bend, Oregon. I actually was cleaning out my garage, and I just so happened to have stumbled upon my old Blockbuster membership. I actually took that membership card, but I did have the pleasure of reactivating my old Blockbuster membership cards. I'm explaining to my 9 and 11 year boys, this is what it used to be like. To literally start at letter A of new releases, and you'd walk the entire floor of Blockbuster going all the way down to Z.
Well, that's a great kicking off point for us to talk about the changing media landscape. And maybe I can throw this first question to Rippon from ZMC. Rippon, you know, you've been in and around media investing for a while. Talk about that classic conversation about distribution versus content in the media business. How has that evolved over the past 20 years? And, you know, what does it say about the opportunities today to invest in, you know, quote unquote media?
One of the big mega trends that we talk about here at ZMC is just the fragmentation of the distribution landscape. So, you know, over the last 30 years, we've moved from a world where you have, you know, a handful of national broadcasters, a handful of national radio stations, to the current time where you basically have infinite channels. The Springsteen song of, you know, 57 channels and nothing's on. It's, you know, thousands of channels between SVOD, AVOD, cable, et cetera. So as a consumer, you know, you've got a lot of choice. And I think that fragmentation has led to content creators and those distribution networks differentiating by the content that they have. And so what you're seeing is a boom in content spending as each one of these endpoints tries to have unique special content to draw audience. So, you know, you see Netflix making headlines, spending, you know, close to $20 billion a year. I think something like 120 plus billion is going to be spent on content just this year alone, really to kind of stem that increase in fragmentation. And for us at ZMC, we've played this by an investment in a business called Nine Story Media, which is a play on kids content. And our belief is that as kind of the world gets more fragmented, that kids content, which tends to be more evergreen and more durable, is something that all these distribution endpoints are going to seek out. And that more or less has played out. You see, you know, HBO buying Sesame Street. You see Disney Plus quickly becoming a top streaming platform. You see Netflix continue to license and produce their own kids content. So far it looks like that trend is playing out, but it's been interesting to kind of watch as the marketplace has evolved.
Julie, from RSM, you have seen an uptick in interest in the actual content, right? Investing in the rights to content, songs, movies, TV shows. Talk about that a bit.
Content's being created all the time. Videos are being posted instantaneously through all these distribution channels, whether it be through the Spotify's or Apple Music and all of that. And so I think that in the music side of things, we are seeing a huge uptick in kind of song catalogs being attractive. You see two huge majors have purchased Paul Simon's catalog, Bob Dylan's catalog. You're seeing other private equity firms get involved as well by buying masters. I think part of that is there's a guaranteed return on already established content and existing franchises that are out there, and they're going up for bid. And we're seeing a lot more of that.
The barriers to entry of getting content from the creator to the consumer are falling apart. Does that actually give greater economics to those who own content and those who create content?
The trend that Julie was speaking to is just an example of, you know, the desire to own proprietary and unique content and have an engine to continuously produce it. And we're seeing that in video, certainly with, you know, the quote unquote streaming wars. You're seeing that in audio with, you know, Spotify and the investments they're making in podcasting. and some of the kind of eye-popping deals that they've been signing. So I think for sure the value is being shifted more so towards the content owner. I mean, you know, the adage that content is king is more true now than it ever has been. And certainly you can see that through the investment activity and the amount of money being spent on it.
Private equity firms, strictly defined, invest in private companies. A collection of song rights, a library of children's content, are those companies, are they businesses that can be optimized and run better? And, you know, where does private equity play a role in optimizing the value of those assets?
Nine Story, which is our kids platform, that's a combination of a studio that's producing content. They also will do production on an outsourced basis for other content creators. So from that perspective, it's kind of a hybrid in terms of what they do. It's not a pure IP business. And our belief and our thesis was, you know, as a business that was primarily focused on the Canadian market, over the last 7 years of our partnership, we've now extended that business globally, and they're now supplying, you know, the Netflixes and the Disneys of the world. So we definitely view it as an operating company who's one of the handful of advantages they have is some proprietary IP. That's how we've played it. We've seen our peers look at content kind of in a more pure form and raise specific funds that focus on that asset class. So as opposed to buying operating companies, they're buying IP rights and creating a portfolio of those, whether they be audio or video. And we've seen more interest in that. We've also seen many, you know, businesses like Hypnosis and Downtown effectively act like large holding companies and investors in their own acquisitions. So I think you're seeing a bit of a blend between kind of pure operating company investing, pure IP investing, and the entities that are involved in it.
I've also been seeing a little bit of entities purchasing kind of the content that we're speaking about and enhancing it a bit. So they're taking maybe a catalog that maybe didn't perform that well, but then bringing in someone and kind of remastering it and making it a little bit more enhanced so that they can really monetize that further than what the original artist or content producer may have experienced at the beginning.
Is it becoming clearer how to monetize portfolios of IP? Obviously, at the height of the, call it, Napster era, there was a question of would people ever pay for, you know, music again, to use music as an example. Are the paths to monetization clear enough that a private investor can underwrite and predict the future cash flows of a collection of content?
I know that it is becoming more clear. I think that there probably still is some uncertainty, but there, as the more and more we're seeing this, the way that we're valuing catalogs, there's becoming more of a systemic way of doing that. So I think that having that approach, and more you get into these type of content catalogs, music catalogs, whatever the case may be, that we are seeing a lot more of kind of the valuation work being done and kind of plugging in play that way. So it is more of a predictable model in a sense.
There just happens to be just a lot of different ways of now monetizing because media has evolved into so many different mediums, right? So now that you've got streaming, it's kind of like, well, how do you monetize on the content as well? But even when you think about, like, for example, music, right? Those YouTube stars or whatnot that are out there that are actually playing background music on their YouTube channel, and people are actually wanting to know what is that song that you're playing on the background. And so I think a lot of, like, for example, music just being one example, they're realizing that people are not necessarily listening to music as much as they kind of used to, but music is being played in the form of video now. So there's a lot of different sort of mediums when you think about all the different collaborations that are now happening and entertainment sort of converging through a lot of different ways. I think you're finding ways that you could actually monetize on content in much different ways than you were able to before, like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I think we've been seeing a similar trend that Julie alluded to. There's certainly a lot more science and kind of rigor around how you predict the value of music IP. And, whether you're, you know, a publishing house or whether you're, you know, a private equity firm, there are kind of more tried and true methods to value it. The part that becomes trickier, at least in our experience, has been the idea that, you know, you can buy this catalog and it's underutilized and, you know, you can embed it in more video content, you can embed it in video games, et cetera. That's a tougher, not impossible, but a tougher thing to quantify. And as a result, you know, with the values that a lot of these catalogs are trading at, we haven't been able to find assets that generate the kinds of returns that we typically target. And so our approach has been to look for kind of derivative plays that benefit from the value of IP and the value of streaming and try to invest in those. As an example, we've been looking at technology to help make the royalty collection process more efficient. So, you know, without going into too much of the vagaries of it, but in general, the typical musician is paid inaccurately and kind of slowly because of the way kind of the royalty ecosystem works. But there is increasingly kind of a technology ecosystem emerging to help alleviate that. And so we've been looking at making investments in those types of businesses that benefit from the overall demand in streaming and hopefully generate, you know, slightly better returns. You know, we'll see if we're successful in doing that. We're very much in hunting mode at the moment.
I'll let you know the moment that I hear Bob Dylan coming from one of my son's video games. that'll be a watershed moment in the media business. Let's talk about another type of convergence that is taking place, which is the blurring of lines between media and what can broadly be defined as software. Maybe Victor, walk us through how, you know, many people who perhaps invested in media companies so defined 20 years ago are now essentially investing in businesses that provide software but act like media assets.
Video gaming is now becoming a huge element of just media and entertainment of the ecosystem overall, right? And when you think about video gaming, you know, there is a sort of software component of that because it has similar sort of parallels and similarities as to how do you go about developing this sort of software or this video game to how do you then, you know, produce and distribute it, you know, through this ecosystem as well. So we're starting to see that become a bigger and bigger play.
Rupan, as you and your partners are thinking about a new media investment or thinking about the prospects for perhaps one of your existing media investments, to what extent do video games come into the conversation?
ZMC is a little unique in the private equity world in that in addition to our fund that we manage, we also separate and apart from that manage a public company, which happens to be Take-Two Interactive, which is a large, you know, global gaming publisher, you know, known for Grand Theft Auto and NBA 2K and games like that. And that's something that, you know, we've been managing for the last 14 years. Some of my partners have, you know, deep knowledge in gaming and the intersection of gaming and media. Not only is the content valuable, but it's creating kind of sports leagues, it's creating betting environments, it's creating adjacent media content around it. You know, through Take-Two, we were investors in Twitch in the early days. And so it's been interesting to watch that ecosystem evolve.
I think a lot of people assume that this is the realm of venture capital, but is there an opportunity for more mature focused private equity firms to get involved in the gaming industry, however you define it?
One of the challenges we found is that the publishers themselves control a lot of the rights and control a lot of kind of the rules of the game. And so it's tough, unless if those publishers are looking to take on, you know, private investment, for us to kind of get involved independently. But, you know, that dynamic may change.
I think private equity firms probably do want to take a hard look at it, just given the increase, the monetization of it. When you look at the incoming generations, like the Gen Zs or whatnot, I mean, their culture is very much surrounded by, a lot of it is through video gaming as well. And you look at the increase of users who are now watching Twitch. I think during the pandemic, it literally doubled as far as, you know, the number of Twitch hours being consumed from 3 billion to 6 billion, right? And you got a platform like Roblox, which is pretty much just targeted to 12, you know, maybe 10 to 16 year olds or whatever it may be. I mean, there's 9 billion of, you know, hours consumed on Roblox on a quarterly basis, right? And you look at the daily active user. So I feel like video gaming and esports is becoming a culture. It's becoming more and more important to understand how do you get in on that and how do you monetize it? Because I feel like it's something even bigger than just seed, angel, or just VC money. There certainly is a lot of monetization that's about to happen in this space.
Fortnite is now doing a concert series. So they have artists come in and they aren't necessarily putting on a live concert, but they're in the Fortnite world and they have their avatar and it's like you're at a concert. So there's just a lot of different avenues for monetization within kind of this gaming world.
Rupan, I want to ask you a question about a term that you used in a planning call for this podcast, which is the democratization of media. I think it touches on a number of themes that we've been discussing, but what does that mean to you?
Yeah, this is another one of these kind of broad macro trends that we've been trying to invest alongside over the last 20 years. But it kind of the way I think about it is, you know, the cost to create and distribute content is going down just as, you know, technology continues to improve. And we're living in a world today where anyone can be a professional creator. You don't have to work for the New York Times to have a platform to write about. You don't need necessarily a record deal to distribute your music. You don't need a radio platform to speak, right? All you really need today is internet access, some sort of digital device, and the willingness to do it. I think now, I think that the term kind of creator economy is what's used to describe this phenomenon, but there's this entire ecosystem of people who have, you know, personal passions that can now turn those into careers. You've seen companies like Patreon and Substack and WordPress become, you know, fairly large technology platforms to enable these creators. And so that when we think about that, we think about kind of what are the opportunities that are now available to people that weren't available, you know, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. We've played this a couple of different ways. One is we have an investment in a company called AdThrive, which is a monetization platform for bloggers. So imagine, you know, if you're passionate, if you're a gamer and you create content around gaming, you know, 10 years ago that was, you know, generally fell on deaf ears, or at least it wasn't something you could do for a living. But our platform allows these creators to create written content, host it on their website, and then we monetize it for them by helping them navigate, you know, what's now a very complicated digital ad ecosystem. It's a huge market. There's, you know, millions of bloggers globally, and growing every day. And our platform has now allowed them to turn that into a real career. And so we see that trend. We have a similar investment in a business that allows small retailers to live stream and sell goods through video, almost like a next generation QVC. So this notion of you know, the barriers to either commerce or to advertising have really fallen, and we've been trying to play it through some of these types of investments.
Looking forward, are you seeing some pretty significant plays developing where private equity capital is involved?
Taking all the complexities in the industry, whether it be music, gaming, all of the above, and figuring out where the royalties lie, who owes who, what artists are owed money, and kind of having a place for people to go who may not be as experienced in that on that side of things. I think that we're seeing a lot of that.
A big play for private equity that have familiarity with media entertainment, but as well as technology. It truly is within this sort of video gaming ecosystem and kind of understanding this a little bit more, because private equity certainly is familiar with software and valuations of software, and they understand that software is highly scalable, right? And I think video gaming is no different. It's a highly scalable platform that can be seen. But then you kind of merge that in again with media and entertainment. So if there's a private equity company that's familiar with how the valuation of media and entertainment, royalties, licensing, and rights, I think those two in combination just create this massive opportunity. It's easy to dismiss video gaming and esports. It was actually easy for RSM to do it, but we're now the only firm who has a specific subsector on video gaming and esports.
One of the key trends we've seen and we've been trying to invest behind is really around commerce enablement. You know, we always viewed media and commerce as kind of, you know, intricately involved with each other. And as one moves online, so, you know, so does the other. And commerce is still early days in online penetration. You know, the pandemic, for better or for worse, has accelerated adoption and certainly shone a light on commerce and that ecosystem. Setting up an online store is easier than it was 10 years ago, but successfully operating one is very challenging. I mean, there can only be so many, you know, direct-to-consumer t-shirt companies out there. And so differentiating your platform, figuring out what tools to use, figuring out how to take payments, what platforms that you want to utilize, are all complicated. And so we've been focused on that ecosystem. We have one investment in that space and are looking to make others. So that's a big trend that we think is going to be around for the next at least 10 plus years.
Great. Well, Rupan, Julie, and Victor, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Perfect. Yeah. Thanks for having us, David.
Thank you, David.
Like what you hear on the PrivCap podcast? Visit PrivCap.com for more thought leadership interviews, articles, reports, webinars, and more.